Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is January 24, 2010, Sunday. Bill Fink is joining us for the fifth installment of Bolshevism in Russia. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello. Praise Yahweh.
Yes, praise Yahweh. And where did we leave off last week? Do you recall?
Well, you had read Report 36 last week.
Yes.
The Russian number one report.
Having to deal with the fact that they have no real support whatsoever. They've hyperinflated the currency, and most of the workers are either working out of a desire to avoid being shot or because it's the only way they obtain food, and that's the same reason most of the soldiers are fighting for the Red Army.
Well, absolutely. The I have something from before we get into reply. I'd put a book up last week on my Mein Kampf site in text format by a Andre Dyke, and it's called The Jews in Russia in the USSR, and he spells out exactly. I mean, it's, you know, the number of Jews in leadership and government positions in Russia is incredible, and he doesn't have Stalin as a Jew. Which he should have, but I think that, you know, a lot of people don't really know that, and that lends to his credibility that he doesn't have Stalin as a Jew, because he wasn't quick to put the, it shows he wasn't quick to apply the label.
Because it's hard to prove at the time.
Well, right, and where it's unknown, he states that it's unknown with a lot of these people. But this, yeah, you know, I just wanted to mention that this is on my Mein Kampf site, and it's on the menu, Books by Others, on the right-hand side. And it really does a good job of explaining just the level of Jewish involvement with Soviet government. And it's just incredible that nobody, or that so few people put together before the war, before World War II, the level of Jewish involvement in Soviet government. And the level of Jewish involvement in American banking that brought us into both of these world wars. It's incredible that they were able to
make the connection.
Yeah, and they got away with that so easily. Or at least it seems like they got away with it so easily in retrospect.
Would you like to begin 37?
Report 37. This is a report from an interview with several businessmen taken by the London by the British diplomats on February 13th, 1919. So we're about, 15 months into the Bolshevism in Russia now, from October 1917. Mr. C and Mr. D were interviewed this morning in the Foreign Office. They both left Petrograd on the 17th of January. Mr. C was a manager of a big firm in Petrograd and was in prison 3.5 months. And we'll see that the Bolsheviks are throwing everybody in prison. And in the cities, the cry of the Bolsheviks has been the proletariat against the bourgeois. Though as most of the big capitalists got away, I wonder why that is. It has really been the oppression of the big bourgeois and the intelligent workmen by the dregs of the population. And what he's trying to explain is that the rich Russian bankers, and I would suppose that most of them were Jews, got away with their money, and this is mentioned a few times throughout these reports, and it really came down to a destruction of the middle class.
Absolutely.
And the better craftsmen, by the Jews and what's called the dregs of the population.
And this begs the question of how they got away. I would say that they knew what was coming, and their Jewish kin weren't going to harm them, even though they appeared to be on the other side of the argument. They appeared to be on the capitalist side of the communist-capitalist debate. They simply came to this country or England, and they set up shop here. All these Eastern Jews, the so-called intelligentsia and the intellectuals that couldn't study in the Soviet Union anymore, they had to flee here, and they just brought communism with them to this country.
Well, absolutely. I have a book on my site. Thanks to General Mosley. Judaism and Bolshevism, a challenge and a reply, some facts concerning Judaism, Bolshevism, and Christianity, and international Jew-controlled finance, Bolshevism, and Zionism, by one A. Homer. And he basically states, that he basically proves that the capitalists are mostly Jewish, and that the Bolshevists are mostly Jewish, and they're both working against Christianity. That they're both seeking to destroy Christianity. He states, "The terror has become a permanent institution by which the Bolshevik Jewish government maintains its tyrannical power over the enslaved millions of Russia and pursues its war on religion." Is exactly how he states it. And he's writing this in the 1920s, I think. He quotes Bernard Lazare in his book, L'Antisemitism. Evidently, it was published in France. The
yeah.
Jew is not satisfied with de-Christianizing. He Judaizes. He destroys Catholic or Protestant faith. He provokes indifference, but he imposes his idea of the world, of morals and of life, upon those whose faith he ruins. He works at his age-old task, the annihilation of the religion of Christ.
Absolutely. And, I posted that quote on a forum, and it took 3 minutes for a Jew to come in there and say that it was a fraudulent quote that I simply invented out of nowhere. And then when I cited the date, the publication information, the page number, and I said, if you want, give me a while, I will get you a scanned image of the actual page. He then changed his tune. He edited his post, removed the accusation that it was fake, and he just started calling me names.
That's what they do. And basically what it boils down to, and any real student of history would know, where you find any white man who is not a Christian or who is anti-Christian, you will find a white man whose brain has been polluted by the Jews. I don't care under what label he claims his anti-Christianity. He might call himself a skinhead or a white nationalist or a neo-Nazi. He might call himself an atheist or an evolutionist, a world church of the creator, whatever he calls himself. He's poisoned and polluted by the Jew. Because the Jew has used all those things as a tool with which to destroy Christianity. Okay, on with this report. I'm sorry, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say the same thing with Masonry. It seems that Masonry has always been a great tool for the Jew.
Well, right. And that kind of brings me to the next book I was going to quote, The Bloody Red Streak. And the Bloody Red Streak is also, thanks to General Mosley, on my Mein Kampf site. And we pick on the British Israel World Federation for not realizing that the Jews are the Edomites of the Old Testament. Well, not all Britons were so blind, because the Bloody Red Streak is written by a Trevor David of the Britons Publishing Society in 1951. And Mr. David had a hell of a lot more on the ball than the British Israel World Federation, that's for sure. He explains that Russia is the Jews' best friend. The Israel leader, Moshe Sneh, was quoted in, what kind of last name is Sneh? S-N-E-H. Was quoted in the Jewish Chronicle of 2nd July 1948 as saying, "Every Jew knew in his heart who was his most consistent and greatest friend? The Soviet Republic." Now, this is a disgrace. Yankee Jew. I would never call any Jew a Yankee, right? Yankee Jew Dr. Lewis G. Reynolds went further. He said, and he quotes, he's quoting the July 5th, 1946 issue of California Jewish Voice. I don't know how you get a Yankee Jew in California. I cannot conceive of any Jew in the role of an enemy of the Soviet Union. Now, isn't this contrary to all the propaganda we were getting about the Soviets and the Jews in the 70s?
Absolutely.
To me, such a Jew is an unnatural monstrosity, a travesty of everything that is decent and right.
Well, you know, I've had some Jews in debates try and tell me that the Soviet Union was anti-Semitic, Stalin wanted to kill all the Jews, and that's why they had to get rid of him. And they said that the Soviet Union wouldn't let the Jews make aliyah to Israel. And I say what it is that come the 60s and 70s, when you people saw your scam was unraveling and falling apart, you had to distance yourself from it. So you started creating the image in people's minds that the Soviet Union was against you, so people wouldn't connect you with the commissars, the NKVD, the gulags, and the murders, which your people had been involved with from day one. I think they saw the writing on the wall, and they knew that their racket was not sustainable indefinitely, so they had to go into damage control mode.
Absolutely. And Trevor David, he describes the Jewishness of communism in the British Empire. The Jewishness of communism in the USA. He names the Jews. The Jewishness of communism in Holland, Belgium, and France. The Common Form and the Common Form World Peace Movement, which we know is all Jewish usurpation of the West. But and then he says, but no communism in Israel. And the reason why. And he says, there is naturally only a minute Communist Party in Israel. Communism is a method whereby the Jews take your country away from you, so they don't want it in their own. And that quote is great, and it's perfectly true.
What page is that on from the Bloody Red Streak?
It's at the top of page 7. It's great. Communism is a method by which the Jews take your country away from you. And that's exactly what they did in Bolshevik Russia, and we're about to we've been seeing that, right? But we're about to see a lot more of it. Communism in Britain is Jewish too, and he names the Jews.
Well, communism is basically a form of Jewish supremacism that is made so it is palatable to the goyish masses.
Absolutely.
Since if the Jew commissar came to town and simply told all the white workers in the mine or at the steel mill, rise up and put us Jews in power, they'd probably laugh at them. But they come by, point to the factory owner, who's generally a fat cat Jew, and say, look at that man, he's abusing you. He won't give you a 15-minute cigarette break every hour. He won't do this. He won't do that. The next thing you know, they've got a communist revolution on their hands.
There is no doubt. Communism has nothing to do with the working class, and we'll see more of that in this Russian number one report soon. In fact, real soon. On with the report, number 37. Now, this report is the British office, foreign office, interviewing two businessmen who were in Russia. They're called Mr. C and Mr. D. They're not even named. And it's just an overview of the state of conditions in Russia. Number one. Or part one, the villages. In the villages, poverty committees, composed of peasants without land and of hooligans returned from the towns, have been set against the peasant proprietor. Local government has been now that would be like the local landowning farmer, the peasant proprietor. He's not a rich man. He's just the guy that happens to own and work the farm down the road. Local government has been handed over to these poverty committees, and they take from the peasant proprietor his produce, implements, and livestock, retaining what they need themselves and forwarding the remainder to the towns. The peasant will not give grain to the Bolsheviks because he hates them and hopes by this means to destroy them eventually. He is armed and united. So we do have a people in the rural areas standing up, it seems.
I would assume, though, that if he won't let them take, they will ultimately take his life.
Well, absolutely. And let me say that this, the scum running the bureaucracy, that reminds me an awful lot about America today, where we see a bureaucratic class which is composed of hooligans and minorities set against the small and independent businessmen and craftsmen. Well, we are, you know, and if you don't believe me, just go to any state or federal welfare office or social services office or tax agency where you live and see who works in them. It's all Jews and minorities and scum. And they're working in they fill all these petty bureaucratic offices, and they're just another class of parasites. And it's the same thing that happened in Bolshevik Russia. It's just happening a lot slower. There they took the 2-year path to destruction, and here we're on the 100-year path to destruction. There's no doubt.
And all of these bureaucrats you talk about, they know that they only got where they got because they've sold out and they're compliant. They take their orders like good sheep. So they know that if they ever try and rise up against the system or even speak out against the system, the gravy train is over. They know their livelihood depends upon the preservation and the maintenance of this system, so they're going to go along with the system no matter what happens, aren't they?
Well, right, just like the white Russian soldier working for the Bolsheviks who was eating, worried about his own belly, and the hell with the rest of your country. Okay, the peasant will not give grain to the Bolsheviks because he hates them and hopes by this means to destroy them eventually. He is armed and united. It is for this reason that the armed requisitioning companies are sent out everywhere from Petrograd and Moscow to help the poverty committees to take grain from the peasant. And every day all over Russia, such fights for grain are fought to a finish, till either the peasants or the requisitioning party are wiped out. During my stay in prison, this is this businessman, I met and talked to dozens of peasant proprietors arrested on the charge of counter-revolution. In my escape across the frontier, I slept in 2 peasants' cabins, and although they were living under the worst conditions, so poor that 14 people lived and slept in a cabin a few yards square, they cursed the Bolsheviks with tears in their eyes. One of the latest decrees only allows a peasant to have 1 cow and 1 horse for every 5 members of his family. The peasant proprietors, who probably will one day be the strongest party in the future Russia, are anti-Bolshevik to a man. Part 2, the Red Army. No more satisfied are the soldiers. In fact, the only troops the Bolsheviks can trust are the Lettish, or Lithuanian, the Chinese, and a few battalions of sailors. They give them 250 rubles a month, all found, together with presents of gold watches and chains, requisitioned from the bourgeois. I guess a Jew can only wear so many watches, right? newly conscripted troops are not given rifles in Petrograd, except a few in each regiment for the purposes of instruction. They are only handed out to them at the front. For any military offense, there is only one punishment, death. Executions are done mostly by the Chinese. Imagine that. If a regiment retreats against orders, machine guns are turned on them, and if the commissar of the regiment cannot thus hold his men, he is shot. All these soldiers I spoke to, even acting as our guards at the prison, cursed their fate at being compelled to serve, the only alternative being death from hunger or execution as deserters. Nearly all openly expressed the hope that the British would soon come and put an end to it all. So they hoped for the British. They put their hopes in the British and they didn't know that the Jews ran Britain too and didn't want to help them.
Would you like me to read the next one? Since this number is going to be another 3 pages long, we can break up the individual parts.
Fine.
Workmen. The position of the workmen is no better. At first, the 8-hour day with high minimum wages greatly pleased them, but as time went on, they found that owing to increased cost of living, they were little, if any, better off. Their wages were increased, but a vicious circle was soon set upon them, which their wages increases were utterly unable to keep up with the high cost of living. Reduction of output further increased the cost. At the Petrograd wagon works, the pre-Bolshevik cost of passenger cars was 16,000 to 17,000 rubles. It is now 100,000 to 120,000. At government works, where the Bolsheviks would be most likely to expect support, intense dissatisfaction exists. An official warning was issued to the workmen of the Putilov Works through the official newspaper, stating that during a period of several weeks, fires, explosions, and breakdowns had regularly occurred, which could only be put down to traitors to the cause, who, when caught, would be shot.
Yeah, it draws a pretty good picture that you really had not much choice, right? Or that people felt they had much choice. Of course, none of them would, if they'd have stuck together, I think they'd have done better, but it was way too late for that. That they went for personal gain, the workmen, and they got burned by it.
Isn't that the great tragedy of our people? We don't really have a community-based collective mentality. It's all, what can I gain as an individual, even if it's at the expense of the community of Jacob Israel as a whole?
Right, and it's obviously what happened here. The workmen were sucked in by empty Bolshevik promises and ended up in much worse condition than they started. But we see the same thing in every single election cycle, don't we?
Absolutely.
For the last 100 years.
They basically shout, you know, jobs, health care, border security, ending the wars, and then we get no border security, open borders, horrible health care, no jobs, and we have more wars.
Well, right, but way too many of our people are simply of the mentality that they're going to vote for the candidate that would give them the most, that they would benefit from the most, not the candidate that would you know, I want the candidate that's going to give me the least, right? I want the government that's going to leave me alone. Yahweh's my God. He'll provide for me.
And anything the government gives you, they don't just create it out of nowhere. They have to take it from someone else.
Well, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's, I think it started with the great influxes of minorities, Southern and Eastern Europeans into this country. And the Jews and the Sicilians and playing up the welfare state to those minorities, and I believe that's how it started, that was our downfall.
You'd say around 1880, 1890?
Oh, definitely, and that's when, you know, the populist parties were popular in that time, and in the 1890s and the early 1900s, William Jennings Bryan, you know, people like of that caliber. And that was a resistance to that. That's what I believe. It was a resistance to that big government mentality.
And it was mostly present in the big cities. The pro-immigrant parties, most of their support came from Chicago, Cleveland, New York, Baltimore, Boston. Am I correct?
Right. And even today, when you look at the I got a copy of it, but I never posted it. The county electoral map for the last election. I mean, all of the big urban centers are densely blue in all of the rural areas. Even up here in New York, I live in a red county in New York. The rural areas where people are notably self-sufficient and, you know, work with their hands and work off the land. Those areas are all conservative red areas.
Well, I'm looking at the map right now. The greatest number of blue counties will be found along the eastern seaboard, the western seaboard, and the major metropolitan areas of the Midwest.
Well, right, and that's where you have all the immigrants. And that's where the Jews have always had the most control.
Not a single county in Oklahoma, for instance, is
right.
Blue.
Right, I'll bet New Jersey has 21 counties and probably 15 of them are blue, and the six that are red, or maybe seven or whatever, are all the. There are some rural counties in New Jersey, believe it or not.
Well, does northwestern New Jersey count as rural?
Oh yes, and southern New Jersey, south central New Jersey.
All right then.
Okay,
the
bourgeois. The position of the bourgeois defies all description. Now, mind you, these are the, and these will be defined here. The bourgeois is really just the middle classes. All who employ labor down to a servant girl or an errand boy or anyone whose wants are provided for ahead, that is, all who do not live from hand to mouth, are considered under Bolshevism as bourgeois. So if you have any property, any savings, any sort of inheritance, any sort of estate, you're bourgeois.
Well, you know,
most of those people are not rich. Yeah, you know, most of the people here that own farms are not rich people. And yeah, you know, if they don't work their farm this year, they're out of business. They'll eat good, but they're out of business if they don't work it.
Well, you know, recently the Seattle Public School came out with a publication on their website, and it said that planning for the future is an anti-black, racist, white concept that reeks of elitism. They went on to say, here, I'll read it. The school defines racism as, quote, those aspects of society that overtly and covertly attribute value and normality to white people and whiteness and devalue, stereotype, and label people of color as other, different, less than, or render them invisible. Examples of these norms include defining white skin tones as nude or flesh-colored, having a future time orientation, emphasizing individualism as opposed to a more collective ideology, defining one form of English as standard, and identifying only whites as great writers or composers. So they said that anyone who plans for the future or teaches individualism over collectivism is a racist.
Wow, you got to get me that. You've got to send me that article. I need that.
All right, I'll do that right now.
That's incredible. That is absolutely Talmudic Jewry speaking right there, right from the heart of Seattle.
I sent it to you. I'm going to post that in the chat too.
Okay, so the bourgeois are basically, as defined by this, that they're basically in the middle class. All newspapers except the Bolshevik ones have been closed, and their plant and property confiscated. New decrees by the dozen are printed daily in the press, no other notification being given. And the Jews love to make laws, right? Non-observance of any decree means confiscation of all property. All government securities have been annulled, and all others confiscated. Safe deposits have been opened, and all gold and silver articles confiscated. All plants and factories have been nationalized, and also the cinemas and the theaters. Well, the Jews were already running the cinemas and the theaters. I don't get it. This nationalization or municipalization means to the unhappy owner confiscation, since no payment is ever made. Payments by the banks from current or deposit accounts have been stopped. It is forbidden to sell furniture or to move it from one house to another without permission. Persons living in houses containing more rooms than they have members of their families have poor families billeted in the other rooms, the furniture in these rooms remaining for the use of the families billeted there. Hundreds of houses have been requisitioned for official or semi-official use, and thousands of unhappy residents have been turned out onto the streets at an hour's notice with permission to take with them only the clothes they stood in, together with one change of linen. Houses are controlled by a poverty committee composed of the poorest residents of the house. These committees have the right to take and distribute amongst themselves from the occupiers of the flats all furniture they consider in excess. They also act as Bolshevik agents, giving information as to movements. A special tax was levied on all house property, amounting practically to the full value of the same. Failure to pay in 14 days resulted in the municipalization of the property. All owners and managers of works, offices, and shops, as well as members of the leisured class, have been called up for compulsory labor, first for the burial of cholera and typhus victims, and later for cleaning the streets, etc. All goods lying at the custom house warehouses have been seized, and first mortgaged to the government bank for 100 million rubles. Any fortunate owner of these goods, which were not finally confiscated, had the possibility of obtaining them on payment of the mortgage. All furniture and furs stored away had been confiscated. All hotels, restaurants, provision shops, and most other shops are now closed after having had their stocks and inventories confiscated. Just before we left, a new tax was brought out, the Extraordinary Revolutionary Tax. In the government newspapers, there were printed daily lists of people, street by street, district by district, with the amount they must pay into the government bank within 14 days on pain of confiscation of all property. The amounts, I noticed, ranged from 2,000 rubles to 15 million. It is impossible to imagine how these sums can be paid. So they just basically seized everything, the Bolsheviks.
Isn't that what they're doing
down.
In this country? They're trying to do that in this country.
Well, yeah, they want everything registered and everything taxed. That's basically the equivalent. It's just a softer form of confiscation, but it boils down to the same thing.
Earlier I was speaking with my father, and I said that the Founding Fathers would regard all these notions of licenses and fees and fines as ridiculous and absurd. They rebelled over far less. We're expected to pay licensing fees for things that are pretty much mundane daily activities, such as owning a dog or going fishing.
Right.
And where does all this money go?
It goes to the Jews. It goes to the Jews to pay the interest on a debt, ultimately, or goes to the Jews who fix all the government contracts and make sure the government spends lots of money.
But I'm sure if you told George Washington or Thomas Jefferson that you have to pay for, quote, the government to grant you the privilege to go fish in a lake for your dinner or you'll go to jail, they would say that that's cause for rebellion.
Well, it's absolutely cause for rebellion, right. But they are all taxes and fees that were always passed early on in the various states and regions where they exist in the name of good. It's so that we can maintain the lake. It's so that we can help you. It's so that we could have money to create access. They were always done in the name of good.
Absolutely.
And people suckered every time it happened. The people got suckered and went for it.
It's all about control.
Absolutely.
Food question.
You going? Okay. All right. Be my guest.
The food question in Petrograd has gone from bad to worse. Elaborate food cards are given out each month covering all kinds of products, but for months past, nothing has been given out on them except bread, which has for the last few weeks consisted of unmilled oats. There are now only three categories of food cards, the first being for heavy workers, the second for workers, and the third for non-workers. The last time bread was given out, the daily allowance on card one was half a pound, on card two, quarter pound, and on card three, 1/8 pound. Hundreds of people are dying weekly from hunger, which first causes acute swelling of the features. Many have managed to get away, so that the present population is probably not more than 600,000. Wholesale starvation has only been prevented by the large illicit trade done in provisions by what are known as sack men, who travel by rail or road from the village with food in sacks. Butter is now 80 rubles a pound, beef 25 rubles, pork 50 rubles, black bread 25 rubles, and eggs 5 rubles each. Dog meat costs 5 rubles a pound and horse meat 18 rubles. Houses with central heating are no longer heated owing to lack of coal. The amount of wood that formerly cost 7 rubles now costs 450, and only enough can be obtained for one room. Restaurants have all been confiscated and turned into communal kitchens, where the sole menu lately has been soup consisting of water with a few potatoes in it and a herring.
Yeah, you know, the description of the food cards, it kind of reminds me of the news reports we used to hear about the Soviet Union when I was a kid in the 70s. And on the news, we were told that people in the USSR would line up for miles in the worst weather conditions with the hope of buying something that we took for granted, like a roll of toilet paper or something. You know, I think those news reports in America were just another form of propaganda coming from the basically the same beast, but we used to hear them a lot. And that's, you know, they're believable, but why did that news get out of Russia? Was that to hang over our heads as a threat? That's the way I look at that.
If you don't comply, this will be your country.
Right, because most news didn't get out of Russia, but that always seemed to get out of Russia at least once every or twice a year.
And I actually saw a report dated from the late 60s. It said that collectivization of agriculture in East Germany boosted output by 400%. You believe that?
Wow.
Now, after the reunification, after the fall of East Germany and the reunification...
I don't think Troublemaker tells lies that big.
They admitted that not only did agriculture not increase, but it dramatically decreased.
Yes, of course, it would dramatically decrease, and we're about to see that here. But collectivization of anything causes productivity to decrease. If we're all going to get paid the same and none of us are going to be happy with what we get paid, none of us are going to work. If there's no reward for your working a little harder or being a little more innovative, if there's no reward for that, then you're not going to work harder and you're not going to be more innovative.
Or I'll do the absolute bare minimum.
Yeah, right. That's the natural law of things. You're going to do the absolute bare minimum. And if you could double your productivity with the idea of a lever, well, you're not going to make the lever to double your productivity because you're not going to get paid anything for it. So you're just going to continue to operate in the same mundane manner and do as little as possible to keep from getting shot, and that's all that matters. The political parties, which have been most oppressed by the Bolsheviks, are the socialists, the social democrats, and the social revolutionaries. Imagine that. Let's get the liberals first. Owing to bribery, who they used, right? Owing to bribery and corruption, those notorious evils of the old regime are now multiplied under Bolshevism. Capitalists were able to get their money from the banks and their securities from safe deposits and managed to get away. Is that the Bolsheviks letting the capitalist Jews get out of the country with their money? That's what
seems
it sounds
so.
Like to me.
The middle-class peasants are killed.
Yeah, right. The white Christian peasants, you mean. On the other hand, many members of the liberal and socialist parties. Now, these sound like white suckers to me.
Useful
who
idiots.
Have worked all their time for the revolution had been arrested or shot by the Bolsheviks. So the rich Jews get away and the white suckers get the guillotine. It's incredible. In prison, I met a social democrat who had been imprisoned for 11 years in the Schlüsselburg fortress as a political offender. Released at the beginning of the Bolshevik Revolution, he was within 18 months imprisoned by the Bolsheviks as a counter-revolutionary. Somebody who did 18 years for the movement, or 11 years for the movement, because basically that 11 years was under the Tsarist regime, and he must have been, you know, an active communist, and they locked him up.
And the same thing with what they did to Maria Spiridonova. Have you heard of her?
No.
She was a Russian revolutionary, absolute radical. She was a socialist revolutionary, member of the Revolutionary Party. And she actually, I believe, she assassinated Police Inspector General Lushkanovsky in 1906 as part of the Decembrist 1905 revolution. She was involved in that. She was then imprisoned. And she was released briefly by the Bolsheviks, but she quickly became a major outspoken critic of them. So they exiled her, and they imprisoned her, and ultimately she was just killed by the NKVD in 1941 after spending probably 30 years in prison.
Wow.
Despite the fact that the peasants adored her and everybody liked her, they say that the NKVD said that she was killed in a prison uprising.
Yeah, right. Okay. Are you going to be part 70? Do you want me to?
How do Bolsheviks continue to hold power? They continue to hold power by a system of terrorism and tyranny that has never before been heard of. This is centered at Gorokhovaya II under the title of the Extraordinary Commission for Combating Counter-Revolution, Speculation, and Sabotage.
Now let me interject something here. Here in modern America, we know that same exact commission is the ADL.
Absolutely.
This commission is described as having become an instrument of the Red Terror, and the works of Robespierre and Torquemada are a mile by comparison. Well, the ADL is in the incubation stages.
This committee or commission is better known as the Cheka. Originally under the direction of Urelsky, it confined its operations to dealing with offenses under these headings, but after his death it came out frankly as an instrument of the Red Terror, and since then its operation makes the history of the French Reign of Terror or the Spanish Inquisition appear mild by comparison. People were arrested wholesale, not merely on individual orders, on information received from spies, but literally wholesale. People arrested in the streets, theaters, cafes, every day in hundreds, and conveyed to Gorokhaeva too. There, their names and other details were entered up, and next day in parties of 100 or so marched to one or another of the prisons, whilst their unhappy relations stood for hours and days in queues, endeavoring to learn what had become of them. They were kept in prison 2, 3, or 4 months without any examination or accusation being made. Then some were accused and shot, fined, or all property confiscated. Others were allowed to be ransomed by their friends, and others released without any explanation. No trial was given. The accusation and examination were made together, and the examiner was generally an ex-workman or even criminal. Examination was made in private, sentence was confirmed by a member of the commission, and that is the only trial anyone ever received at Gorokhaeva II. The climax was reached after the murder of Uritsky, attack on the British embassy, and the Lockhart affair, where hundreds of people were arrested in various parts of the town, mostly officers, who were shot and thrown into the river, bound and thrown into the river, or bound, put into barges, and the barges sunk, all without even the formality of being taken to Gorokhaeva II. I was in prison from 19th September to 25th December, and I could pretty well fill a book with my experiences, but I will merely give a translation of an article printed in a Bolshevik paper, The Northern Commune, number 170, dated 4th December 1918. It is impossible to continue silent. It has constantly been brought to the knowledge of the Verborg Soviet, Petrograd, of the terrible state of affairs existing in the city prisons, that people all the time are dying there of hunger, that people are detained 6 and 8 months without examination, and that in many cases it is impossible to learn why they have been arrested, owing to officials being changed, departments closed, and documents lost. In order to confirm or otherwise these rumors, the Soviet decided to send on 3rd November a commission consisting of the President of the Soviet, the District Medical Officer, and District Military Commissar to visit and report on Crest Prison. Comrades, what they saw and what they heard from the imprisoned is impossible to describe. Not only were all rumors confirmed, but conditions were actually found much worse than had been stated. I was pained and ashamed. I myself was imprisoned under Tsardom in that same prison, when all was clean and prisoners had clean linen twice a month. Now not only are prisoners left without clean linen, but many are even without blankets, and as in the past, for a trifling offense they are placed in solitary confinement in cold, dark cells. But the most terrible sights we saw were in the sick bays. Comrades, there we saw living dead who hardly had strength enough to whisper their complaints that they were dying of hunger. In one word, amongst the sick, a corpse had lain for several hours, whose neighbor managed to murmur of hunger. He died, and soon of hunger we shall all die. Comrades, amongst them are many who are quite young, who wish to live and see the sunshine. If we really possess a workman's government, such things should not be.
Now, this is in direct opposition to the way that the Bolshevik Jews operated here throughout the 20th century. The Bolshevik, for many decades, the Jews have taken up the cause of letting every scumbag in the world out of our prisons.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, the poor black axe murderer was oppressed when he was a child, and you have to give him parole. Yeah. And it's the same story over and over again.
Absolutely.
But as soon as they get charged, all the white people go to prison.
And all the violent offenders become the guards.
Well, right, exactly. They get elevated into government. All the minority scum, the real criminals, get elevated into government. And people don't just see it. It's not a matter of right and wrong. It's not a matter of different sorts of economic systems. That's not the struggle. The struggle is the Jew and the Christian.
Absolutely.
That's the only struggle.
Good and evil.
Absolutely.
And I'd like to read a quote from the head of the Cheka, Felix Dzerzhinovsky. This is from 14th July 1918. Quote, "We stand for organized terror. This should be frankly admitted. Terror is an absolute necessity during times of revolution. Our aim is to fight against the enemies of the Soviet government and of the new order of life. We judge quickly. In most cases, only a day passes between the apprehension of the criminal and his sentence. When confronted with evidence, criminals in almost every case confess. And what argument can have greater weight than a criminal's own confession?" End quote.
That's absolutely it. And they'll let every Jewish ACLU lawyers have worked against white civilization in the West for the last 100 years. Every day they're at it. At trying to get the minority the easiest ride possible and make it as hard as possible for the Christian. So if you're a Christian cross-bearer and post the Ten Commandments somewhere, you're going away for life. But if you're a nigger axe murderer and raped 300 young college co-eds, well, you were oppressed and it's not really your fault, and maybe you should be let out after 5 years.
The white man was holding you down.
Yeah, right. And that's been, I mean, those are extreme examples, but that's been a general attitude of the Jew lawyer, the liberal Jew lawyer in America, and it's a purposeful attempt at a slow destruction of our society, where in Bolshevik Russia they did it all in a year and a half.
And about Felix Dzerzhinovsky, Jewikipedia does not list him as a Jew, despite the fact that they concede that his father was of Jewish ancestry and he himself spoke Yiddish and Hebrew. They say that he's a Polish noble since his mother was Polish and he was raised Catholic and became an atheist.
He's a Jew.
Absolutely.
No doubt. Yeah, right. Well, Jews don't claim, you know, they claim their lineage through the mother, which proves they're not the people of the Bible.
Absolutely.
They're definitely not the people of the Bible who always claim their lineage through the father.
Very, very valid point. I've often pointed that out to people, that the Jews can't possibly follow Mosaic law since the people of Moses were patriarchal.
Absolutely. Part 8, Bolshevik plans for world revolution. Mind you, this was written in 1919. Bolshevism in Russia offers to our civilization no less a menace than did Prussianism. Of course, the English didn't like the Germans either. And until it is as ruthlessly destroyed, we may expect trouble, strikes, and revolutions everywhere. The German military party are undoubtedly working hand in hand with Russian Bolsheviks with the idea of spreading Bolshevism ultimately to England, by which time they hope to have got over it themselves and to be in a position to take advantage of our troubles. And that's, you know, this is a that this writer is taken in by a lot of Jewish English propaganda. The capitalist propaganda, the Rothschild propaganda. But he does have a fair accusation against the Germans, because they did, in part, help finance the Bolshevik Revolution. That, there's no doubt. We proved that. And that's sad, but that's a circumstance that was obviously necessitated by World War One, where Germany was fighting the Russian Tsarist, you know, the Tsar's army and the English on two fronts. Okay. For Bolshevik propaganda, unlimited funds are available. Now, where do those unlimited funds come from?
Wall Street.
Absolutely. Wall Street and the House of Rothschild. And that Englishman, this Englishman evidently doesn't know that. That's not known yet. That's not known for some years after, I don't think.
Unlimited funds don't come from nowhere.
Right. Unlimited funds can only come from the Jews that print the money. Okay. No other country can give their secret services such a free hand, and the result is that their agents are to be found where least expected. And you know, this Englishman here is declaring Bolshevik plans for a world revolution. And I think that the our investigation, you know, and, well, many others also, of course, of the Frankfurt School proves that the Jews did indeed get their world revolution, and they won. And the living proof is in the White House right now.
Absolutely. And the fact that Jews are basically running, either directly or indirectly, every single country in Europe. They have a Jew as the leader of France. They have Jew pawns as leaders in Great Britain. They have a Jew pawn mulatto running this country.
Well, right. And Jews, you know, even when they don't have the helm of a nation, which is only a figurehead, they have all the main offices, all the major offices, all the bureaucracies, and all of the positions behind the helm, behind the figurehead. I mean, look at the last several White House cabinets were dominated by Jews.
All right. Number 38, General Knox to War Office, Telegraphic, Omsk, February 5, 1919. With regard to the murder of Imperial Family Eddie Krattenberg, there is further evidence to show that there were two parties in the local Soviet, one which was anxious to save Imperial Family, and the latter headed by five Jews, two of whom were determined to have them murdered.
Now let me say that, you know, all the early reports still left it, leave us with the definite impression that the whole royal family was exterminated.
All right. These two Jews, by name Vinanin and Safarov, went with Lenin when he made a journey across Germany. On pretext that Russian guard had stolen 70,000 rubles, they were removed from the house between the 8th and the 12th. The guard were replaced by a house guard of 13, consisting of 10 Letts and 3 Jews, two of whom were called Lepont and Yarowski, and one whose name is not known. The guard was commanded outside the house by a criminal called Medayayev, who had been convicted of murder and arson in 1906 and of outraging a girl of 5 in 1911.
Well, that's Talmudic. I mean, that's, you know, that's permissible in the Talmud.
So we can assume that this guard is a Jew.
Right. Under a certain age, and the Talmud says that little girls can be violated because their hymen grows back into place before they're in puberty.
And leave it to a rabbi to look for that kind of loophole in the law.
Absolutely. That's a rabbi-manufactured loophole, actually.
Absolutely. The prisoners were awakened at 2 in the morning and were told they must prepare for a journey. They were called down to the lower room an hour later, and Yarowski read out the sentence of the Soviet. When he had finished reading, he said, "And so your life has come to an end." The emperor then said, "I am ready." An eyewitness, who has since died, said that the empress and the two eldest daughters made the sign of the cross. The massacre was carried out with revolvers. The doctor, Botkin, the maid, the valet, and the cook were murdered in this room, as well as the 7 members of the imperial family. They only spared the life of the cook's nephew, a boy of 14. The murderers threw the bodies down the shaft of a coal mine, and the same morning orders were sent to murder the party at Alapovsk, which was done.
So this is a lot more sure about the deaths of the imperial family than the earlier reports, which always seemed to leave open the possibility that they escaped. That was how I read them, anyway.
And this seems to definitively say they're dead.
Yes, it does. This is the first report, I think, that definitively says that.
If the eyewitness accounts that he's referencing can be trusted.
And the one eyewitness is conveniently dead, according to the report. Not that it would matter that we could track him down anyway, but... Number 39, Mr. Alston to Earl Curzon, February 12, 1919, from Vladivostok, February 10th. Following from consular officer at Ekaterinburg, February 8th. So this is a third-hand report. From examination of witnesses of various classes of the population, following evidence obtained, Bolsheviks persecuted all classes of the population, not supporting or recognizing their government. House searches, requisitions, and arrests were made at all times of day and night on the grounds of political necessity, resulting in wholesale pillage. Anybody possessing more than 10,000 rubles was forced to dig, trenches at the front for the Red Army. So they were condemned for having too much cash, where they are under continual menace of death for the slightest offense, and at the mercy of the Red Guard, very often consisting of foreigners, Chinese. Many of these persons were murdered. 18 peaceful citizens, including priests, doctors, lawyers, and merchants, and laborers, were arrested at Ekaterinburg as hostages and shot without any accusations being made against them. 65 citizens from Kamishov suffered the same fate. The widows of these people who claimed their husbands' bodies were treated with outrageous insult and derision by the Bolsheviks. Peasants in the Bolshevik district who protested against requisition of their cattle and property were thrown into prison, and 90 of them were murdered. Peasants also had their houses burnt, as many as 100 being destroyed in one village. Bolshevik leaders in Ekaterinburg led a life of luxury entirely in opposition to doctrine they advocated, frequently appropriating large sums of money and indulging in drunken orgies. Bribery, corruption, and extortion were rife amongst both Bolshevik officials and Red Guard men. Bolsheviks particularly oppressed Orthodox clergy and religion. So here we see a war against Christianity, and Bolshevism is really the Jewish takeover of a nation and the appropriation of all of its wealth for a few Jews. That's what it boils down to.
It's just Jewish hypocrisy.
Right. Exactly. All the propaganda was lies, which is what comes out of the mouth of Satan anyway. And they used all the communist, the noble-sounding equality propaganda to steal the whole country. Czech soldiers' witnesses give evidence that near Khan, Bolsheviks crucified father and sisters of a man who served in the National Army. Whole families of others in National Army were shot. There is sufficient information to hand to be able to state that Bolsheviks' crimes in Ekaterinburg district are nothing in comparison with the number and character of atrocities committed in Perm and in that district. I'd like to quote from the Bloody Red Streak. Communism has nothing to do with the working class. Communism is, of course, nothing whatsoever to do with the working class. The working class figures only in the abstract in communist propaganda. But in communist revolutions, the working class is to do the dirty work for their Jewish masters. If the revolution succeeds, the Jews ride to power on the backs of the working class. It's exactly what we're seeing here in Russia number one. If the revolution fails, the working class go to jail or the firing squad and the gallows. We can see the truth of the anti-working class nature of communism by the presence in Britain and Western Europe of hundreds of thousands of Polish, Ukrainian, Yugoslav, and even Russian workers, all of whom have fled from the so-called workers' paradises of Russia and Eastern Europe, and who would rather commit suicide than return. It will also be remembered that when Madame Kasinkina, Russian schoolmistress at the Russian consulate in New York, heard that she was returning to the workers' paradise, she hurled herself out of a skyscraper window in an effort to commit suicide. Her boss was the Jew, Jacob Lomakin, the so-called Russian consul general in New York. Communism, and I skipped a few paragraphs, I'm on page 9 now with the Bloody Red Streak. Communism is, in fact, a confidence trick whereby Jews acquire a nation's wealth by pretending to nationalize it for the working classes. Communist leaders themselves make no bones about this, after they get into power, of course. For instance, Matyas Rakasi, a Jew communist dictator of Hungary today, of an all-communist cabinet of five Jews whose sole Gentile, Laszlo Radzic, was hanged for anti-Semitism, which is a clue as to what may happen to the other Gentile stooges, and I'm paraphrasing now, plainly stated, this Jew communist, plainly stated as recently as the 31st of May 1949, in a violent attack on the Hungarian working class for slackness, that socialism does not imply equality, and jeered at them for foolishly supposing that the shares of the factories would be taken over and divided among themselves. In other words, he came out and admitted honestly that communism and socialism were only a way for the Jews to steal their country.
But haven't we been hearing, I haven't really been hearing since I wasn't around at the time, but I'm sure you heard Soviet leaders always talking about how they were on the path to true communism and how the system just needed to have a few kinks ironed out, and any day now the Soviet citizens would be enjoying the wonders of the communist paradise.
And that was always a continuation of the same propaganda, an excuse for it's not bearing fruit for so many years. That was all that was. They had to put that USSR beast to death. It was becoming too obviously blatant that the system was a failure, and they would have no hope of perpetuating it elsewhere. So they put it to death, and it was all a sham. The Yeltsin Revolution was all a staged act so that the Jews could finally finish the deal and seal their ownership of Soviet Russia.
And now stupid Americans can pat themselves on the back and say, we defeated communism.
Absolutely. We didn't defeat a damn thing. The Jews gave up and decided just to convert their tyranny into stock. And that's exactly what they did. They converted their tyranny into stock, and 10 Jews ended up with owning the country. The oligarchs. It's a joke. It's a joke that people fall for it. It's a joke that academics believe that crap. Men that are supposed to be learned, they believe that. They swallow that line of bull, hook, line, and sinker. And most of us let them get away with it.
For all intents and purposes, the Soviet Union still exists.
It absolutely still exists. And it's headquartered in London with its largest operating branch on Wall Street.
All right, then. Number 40. Mr. Alston to Earl Curzon. Vladivostok, February 13, 1919. Mr. T has just arrived here from Ekaterinburg. When at Perm, he says he lived in same hotel with Grand Duke Michael and Mr. Johnson, his secretary, who was a Russian. At 2 a.m. on or about the 16th June, he saw four of Perm militia, or police, take them off, and he is convinced that they were killed. Previous reports of Bolshevik excesses at Perm are confirmed by Mr. T, who says that usual method employed by them in the case of merchants was to arrest them, release them, rearrest them, bail them again, amount of bail to be paid increasing each time, and to shoot them in the end.
Well, it confirms the earlier reports that this Grand Duke was dead. This came out in an earlier report that Grand Duke Michael was dead. And the following subsequent report, number 41, is only a confirmation of earlier reports we had read also. This is the acting consul Bell to Earl Curzon, February 13, 1919, from Helsingfors, February 12, 1919. I learned on good authority that the Grand Dukes Paul Alexandrovich, Dmitry Konstantinovich, Nikolai Mikhailovich, Georges Mikhailovich, who were all confined in Petrograd in prison for preliminary investigation, were removed on 29th January 1919 to Peterampol Fortress, where, on the same day, without further investigations, they were killed by Red Guards with revolver shots. It is said that Princess Palej, the widow of the late Grand Duke Paul Alexandrovich, escaped from Petrograd after the murder of the Grand Duke. So they killed off the noble class, and these are confirmations of really reports we read.
Isn't that what they always do? They've done that in the French Revolution. They've done that in every revolution they've ever instigated.
Right, they kill off the white nobility. And we'll see here, we'll see here in a report coming up that they actually killed a great number of the Russian army officers returning from the German front. Men who did nothing wrong. They weren't even there for the Bolshevik Revolution. They were returning from the German front. They came back. The Bolsheviks killed them. And what they're doing is they're eliminating the priests and the army officers and anybody else who has the intellectual capacity to challenge them, to present the challenge to them. That's what they're doing.
And I'm reading here on Wikipedia, they say that Paul Alexandrovich was killed in 1919, but his widow was able to flee, and she died in exile about 20 years later. I'm sorry, about 10 years later in Paris.
Well, that's who we just spoke about, right? That's who we just...
It says here that the princess was killed, the widow of late Grand Duke... Oh, no, wait, I'm sorry, it says she escaped. Okay, I thought it said she was killed after the murder. Okay.
And McBragg just quoted the Talmud, the best of the Goyim should be killed. And that's exactly true. But that's because these are the men that have the ability, and the Bolsheviks would fear the possibility that they might be able to organize an armed resistance. So they eliminate them at every turn, every chance they get. On the possibility that they might be challenged.
Number 42. Consul General Baggy to Earl Curzon received February 16th, dispatched telegraphic, Odessa, February 13, 1919. Widespread pillage by bands, murder of landowners, even of peasants with few acres, has created very grave situation. Seed grain is largely lacking in consequence for spring sowing in Ukraine. As these normally cover 70% of whole area, if measures are not taken at once to replace supply from Kuban and elsewhere, there will be no crop and consequently terrible famine. This state of things applies to peasants as well as large landowners, the majority of whom have had to flee to coastal towns. The cardinal condition for saving Russia from famine is maintenance of order in occupied territory or South Russia. Thousands of peasant landowners, when they have moral and some physical support, will be able to cope with bands of robbers under whatever names these may act. These peasants further beg that property now existing in land be declared inviolable until whole question shall be settled. Without this assurance, they do not care the risk expense of sowing for perhaps another to reap. The question is very urgent, for work on land in the South begins in 3 to 4 weeks. And we see that that's what communism does. It takes away the incentive to work. Why would you work for 6 months if at the end of it some commissar is going to come by with a band of NKVD or Cheka thugs and take everything you worked for?
Absolutely. Let me quote from The Bloody Red Street. Communism and Judaism are one and the same. Other similarities between communism and Judaism are, 1, hatred of Christianity. The Russians, far from hating Christianity, are one of the most religious races on earth. Religious even to the point of superstition. The anti-Christian campaign in communist Russia is Jewish. The Jews have hated Christianity ever since they got Christ crucified by Pontius Pilate. Let us compare a communist on Christianity with a Jew. The Soviet education commissar, Lunacharsky, defined the communist attitude to Christianity as follows. We hate Christianity and Christians. Even the best of them must be looked upon as our worst enemies. They preach the love of our neighbors and mercy, which is contrary to our principles. Christian love is an obstacle to the development of the revolution. Down with the love of our neighbors. What we want is hatred. We must learn how to hate, and it is only then that we shall conquer the world. Millionaire Hollywood Jew playwright Ben Hecht, who went wild with delight every time a British soldier was murdered in Palestine, writes on page 120 of his book, A Jew in Love, one of the finest things ever done by the mob was the crucifixion of Christ. Intellectually, it was a splendid gesture. But you trust the mob to bungle. If I had charge of the executing Christ, I'd have handled it differently. You see, what I'd have done was to have him shipped to Rome and fed to the lions so that they could not have had a savior out of mincemeat. This struggle is, Christians, it's a shame they're so blind that only two seedline identists are awake to the fact that this struggle is much older than Christianity. Because as Richtar brought up in the forum, we talk about the Jews exterminating the noblemen, the white noblemen in the French Revolution, and we talk about how they're exterminating all the noblemen, the white Christian noblemen in the Bolshevik Revolution. Well, they did the same thing when the Edomites, which is what the Jews were called in 120 BC, when the Edomites took over the kingdom of Judea after they were let into it, the actual takeover didn't happen until about 40 BC with Herod the Edomite, when he got by bribery the Romans to declare him the king. He went and he killed all of the last of the Maccabees, who were the real ruling family, the Hasmonean dynasty of Judea.
Because they could challenge.
The first thing he did was kill everybody who might challenge his kingship, which he gained by bribing the Romans. Which he gained by bribing Mark Antony. I think Josephus said it was with 900 talents of silver. So we see the same pattern in Judea 150 years before Christianity, which actually, it's actually 70 years before the ministry of Christ. And that is, that's the pattern they followed ever since. But at that time, that set the stage for the murder of Christ by the enemies of God. And the Jews are the enemies of God, and they always have been. And they always will be. Okay, where are we? Number 43?
Yes.
Sir C. Eliot to Earl Curzon. Received February 20th. Vladivostok, February 19th, 1919. Following from Consulate Ekaterinburg. Desertions from Red Army increasing. It seems like the British diplomats are still in hope that the Bolshevik regime is going to fall on its own. And peasants in Bolshevik Russia mutinying on mobilization. Peasant insurrections occurred. The Penza government, also Ohansk and the Syzran districts. Mutinies of newly mobilized troops took place at Tambov, Kursk, Kasan, Nizhny Novgorod, and other places. According to Russian prisoner returning from Germany, insurrections against the Bolsheviks took place between Viatka and Glazov. 30 Orthodox priests were massacred by the Bolsheviks at Avsa. 500 Russian officers returning from Germany were shot at Menzelinsk. So there you have it. It's just a wholesale slaughter of the white middle class and anybody who might pose a challenge to them.
Isn't that what they do in every country they wind up coming to power in? They kill. They call it the intelligentsia. They label them counter-revolutionaries and they kill them all.
They did it in France. They did it in Judea. They do it here as soon as they could get away with it.
And in a way, aren't they sort of doing it right now by forcing certain people into retirement, marginalizing them, assigning their jobs to other people, moving them into dead-end posts, and
ending their
career?
We are on the slow road to destruction. There is no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. They're just doing it quietly in a more palatable fashion. They outsource your job, or they fire you and replace you with a black who's compliant and who doesn't really care, someone who's docile and can be controlled, instead of dragging you out in the woods and shooting you.
Well, absolutely.
But the end result is still the same. They marginalize and dispossess our people, and they put another people above us.
Well, we are dispossessed. I mean, a white man can't go for a civil service job and get a fair shake.
All right. Number 44. Sir Eliot to Earl Curzon, received February 23. Dispatched, Vladivostok, February 22, 1919. Following report of 71 Bolshevik victims received from consular office Eddie Krattenberg, dated 19 February. Numbers 1 to 18 Ekaterinburg citizens, first three personally known to me, were imprisoned without any accusation being made against them, and at 4 in the morning of 29th June were taken, with another making 19 altogether, to Ekaterinburg's sewage dump, half mile from Ekaterinburg, in order to stand in line alongside of newly dug ditch. 40 armed men in civilian clothing, believed to be communist militia, and giving impression of semi-intelligent people, opened fire, killing 18. The 19th, Mr. Chistosardo miraculously escaped in general confusion. I, together with other consuls at Ekaterinburg, protested Bolsheviks against brutality, to which Bolsheviks replied advising us to mind our own business, stating that they had shot these people to avenge death of their comrade Malyshev, killed at front against Czechs.
So they basically kill a bunch of villagers hundreds of miles away because their comrade was killed at the front against the Czechs. What kind of excuse is that? Yeah, you know,
like
it's like, I killed your wife because I got to hang now. Yeah, you know, it's crazy. And that's the Jew rational. That's the mind of Satan at work right there.
Or
there's no doubt that's the mind of Satan.
That'd be like saying, my brother got killed in Iraq, so I'm going to go kill some French Canadians.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. It's totally ridiculous. Okay, go on.
Numbers 19 and 20 are two of 12 laborers arrested for refusing to support Bolshevik government and on 12th July thrown alive into hole into which hot slag deposits from works at Veretsky near Ekaterinburg.
That's the satanic bloodlust, the satanic joy in other people's turmoil and pain and suffering.
Bodies were identified by fellow laborers. Numbers 21 to 26 were taken as hostages and shot at Kamishlov on 20th July. Numbers 27 to 33, accused of plotting against Bolshevik government, arrested 16 December at village of Troitsk, Perm government, taken 17th December to Station Silva, Perm railway, and all decapitated by sword. Evidence
when a Jew gets in charge of the heads roll, he loves decapitating people. I'm sorry, Brian.
Evidence shows that victims had their necks half cut through from behind, head of number 29 only hanging on small piece of skin.
We had a menorah on a White House lawn this year, and next year we might have a guillotine.
Numbers 34 to 36 taken with eight others beginning of July from camp, where they were undergoing trench digging services for Bolsheviks to spot near Ufalai, about 80 verst from Ekaterinburg, and murdered by Red Guards with guns and bayonets. Numbers 37 to 58 held in prison at Irbit as hostages, and 26th July murdered by gunshot, those not killed outright being finished off by bayonet. These people were shot in small groups, and murder was conducted by sailors and carried out by lets, all of whom were drunk. After murder, Bolsheviks continued to take ransom money from relatives of victims from whom they concealed crime. Number 59 was shot at village Klevenitsky, Vertoya district, 6th August, being accused of agitation against Bolsheviks. Number 60, after being forced to dig his own grave, was shot by Bolsheviks at village Merchanivsky.
Which is Vertoya, something they repeatedly accused the Nazis of doing.
Absolutely, but we'll never see any movies about this, will we?
No, we'll never see this in Hollywood. But if you go to see any Holocaust movie and you imagine that everybody wearing Nazi uniform is really a Bolshevik and every dying Jew is really a dying Russian Christian, then it would become a documentary.
Well, you know, there's a movie, what was it, that Spielberg one. I've never seen it, Schindler's List, but they actually start off, they have the road leading into the concentration camp paved with graves taken from a Jewish cemetery. And that never happened.
Well, of course it never happened. None of that movie ever happened.
Doesn't that sound like something that the Bolsheviks would do?
There may have been
a sellout
somewhere in Germany named Schindler. I wouldn't doubt it, but... all right, go on. You're almost done.
Number 62... Number 61, murdered middle of July at Kamensky Works for allowing church bells to be sounded, contrary to Bolshevik orders. Body afterwards found with others in hole with head half cut off. Number 62, arrested without accusation, 8th July at village, Oyetsky, Kamishlov district. Body afterwards found covered with straw and dung, beard torn from face with flesh, palms of hands cut off, and skin incised on forehead. Number 63 was killed after much torture, details not given, 27th July at station Anthracite. Number 67, murdered, 13th August, near village of Muranovsky. Number 68, shot by Bolsheviks before his church at village of Kurovsky, Kamishlov district, before eyes of villagers, his daughters and son, date not stated. Number 69 to 71, killed at Koslinsky, works near Kishtim, 4th June, together with 27 other civilians. Number 70 had head smashed in, exposing brains. Number 71 had head smashed in, arms and legs broken, and 2 bayonet wounds. Dates in this telegram are 1918.
That's the work of Satan. That's the work of the Jews. That's what they do.
Well, you know, I think I read this on the program before, but in 1961, on March 15, communist blacks from the Congo marched down into Portuguese Angola and proceeded to massacre about 10,000 non-communist blacks, several thousand mulattoes, and several thousand whites. And they were trained and equipped by the Soviet Union, China, Algeria, the United States of America, and Israel. And in one instance, they crucified an 18-year-old white girl after basically trying, they did certain things that I'm not even going to say. They basically skinned her alive, and while she was still alive, they crucified her. And you know, somewhere in the works, a Jew had to inspire them to do that.
Absolutely. There's no doubt.
And it should be shocking to most people that the United States trained and equipped and funded the same groups that the Soviet Union, the Chinese, the Algerians, the Romanians, and the East Germans were training, equipping, and funding.
Well, we were on the Soviet Union side in World War II. Why wouldn't we stay there?
Exactly. And all these people who are waiting for the British to do something, they basically were waiting an awful long time. They're still waiting, aren't they?
Yes, they are. The Jews,
all right.
I'm quoting from the Bloody Red Streak again, the Jews, by their Bible, the Talmud, are allowed to cheat, rob, and deceive Gentiles. Communists rob Gentiles of all they possess by simply nationalizing all property off them on pretense of giving it to the workers, but actually they keep it for themselves. They intend to rob your savings off you by a capital levy and eventually your house or farm by nationalization of the land. The communists, by Lenin's direct orders in his book Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder, are allowed to use lies, deceit, and subterfuge to non-communists. And let me say, that's exactly the same thing that Muslims are allowed to do to non-Muslims, and it's exactly the same thing that Jews are allowed to do in the Talmud to non-Jews. No value, therefore, should be placed on the descriptions of Russia and communist Eastern Europe and communist China by communists who have returned from carefully conducted tours there. Their orders are by that mass murderer Lenin, whose rotting corpse lies pickled in a glass jar in Moscow and is to them a substitute for a god, to lie about the real nature of communism to you. It is my firm belief that communism won't be destroyed until the carcass of Lenin is given a decent Christian burial. And I think he's a little misled there, because that just should never happen.
They should throw his body to the dogs.
The Jews are a geographically international people. The communists are a geographically international party. And he goes on to describe how the Second World War was entirely Jewish.
And the fact that the Russians still venerate Lenin, and Stalin was ranked as the most third popular Russian of all time, despite the fact that he's neither Russian nor did he do anything for Russia, that shows that Russians are still pretty brainwashed and they love communism.
Yes, it's incredible. That poll that you cited about Stalin is just incredible, that so many Jews would think Stalin to be anywhere near a national hero is incredible.
I mean, he was a Jew by ethnicity and a Georgian by nationality. There was nothing Russian about him.
Nothing Russian about him. And there was nothing great about him. He killed 20 million Russians, at least.
Hmm.
20 million white Christian Russians.
If Russia was really this great bastion of white nationalism, wouldn't they storm the Kremlin or the mausoleum, wherever Lenin's putrid corpse is being stored, and they would drag it out and throw it to the dogs?
Absolutely. Number 45, Sir C. Eliot to Earl Curzon, Vladivostok, February 24th, from Yekaterinburg, originally, from the consul at Yekaterinburg. Numbers 72 to 103 examined 32 civilians incarcerated as hostages and taken away by the Bolsheviks, with 19 others at various dates between the 9th of July and the 7th of August. On the 27th of July, all 51 had been declared as outlaws. Official medical examination of 52 bodies. This is confusing, this report. Of which 32 were examined and 20 were not identified, found in several holes. Three from Kamishlov revealed that all had been killed by bayonet, sword, and bullet wounds. Following cases being typical, number 76 had 20 light bayonet wounds in the back. Number 78 had 15 bayonet wounds in the back, 3 in the chest. Number 80 had 80 bayonet wounds in the back, broken jaw and skull. Number 84, face smashed and wrist backed, hacked. Number 89 had 2 fingers cut off and bayonet wounds. Number 90, both hands cut off at the wrist, upper jaw hacked, mouth slit at both sides, bayonet wound in the shoulder. Number 98, little finger off left hand and 4 fingers off right hand, head smashed. Number 99 had 12 bayonet wounds. That they were, these people were beaten to death. It's ridiculous to go on. That they were beaten to death and hacked to death by the Bolsheviks.
So it was a Jewish blood orgy.
Yes, absolutely. You want to read number 46?
All right. Sir Eliot to Mr. Balfour, received February 25th. Dispatch, Vladivostok, February 24, 1919. An appeal to all democratic parties to unite against Bolsheviks has been published by the OMS government.
Now, the OMS government was formerly a Bolshevik government.
Hmm.
All right, go on. It was, you know, they're talking about the OMS government under the Bolsheviks, had revolted from the Bolsheviks here. It seems to me that's what's being said, unless I'm wrong.
Reasons given are as follows. One, dictatorship of one class was claimed by Bolsheviks, and people of other classes were placed outside the law and starved. Two, Bolsheviks have deprived educated classes of their votes, as they do not admit universal suffrage. Three, bureaucracy has been set up in place of municipal and village government, which has been abolished. Four, political organizations have replaced law courts. End report.
And this is another way that we are very much like the Bolsheviks. Yeah, you know, bureaucracy has been set up in place of municipal and village government, and all these federal agencies are always telling our states, counties, and towns what to do. That they hold a tremendous amount of authority over our states, counties, and towns, usually through the granting or withholding of federal monies.
Yes,
but
and I found
we also have a trend. I'm sorry, we have another trend, and it's been going on for about 30 or 40 or maybe years or maybe a little longer, of the Economic Development Corporation, like we saw recently at this, you know, last year in the news in Hardin, Montana, where an Economic Development Corporation supplants local self-rule and supplants the will of the people. And that's very common here now. Go on.
And I found a New York Times article from 1918, November, headline, Omsk government may be recognized. French High Commissioner arrives at capital of all Russian cabinet to investigate, is favorably impressed. American Consul General Harris of Irkutsk to report on situation to Washington by Carl Ackerman. Omsk, November 11, Eugene Renault. The French High Commissioner has arrived on a special train from Vladivostok. Next week, Consul General Harris of Irkutsk is expected here representing America. Mr. Renault's presence in the temporary capital of the all-Russian government and the announcement that Consul General Harris will investigate for Washington, coupled with Sir Charles Eliot's recent visit, indicates that France, England, and the United States are showing official interest in the new Russian government, which contemplates the reorganization of the whole of Russia and the establishment of a government which will succeed the Bolsheviks. The presence of these men, however, does not indicate that the Allies are ready to recognize officially this government as Russia's real power, but that the Allies see possibilities in this cabinet for Russia's reorganization. Mr. Renault, who met with a splendid reception from the Russians and Czechs en route, came here impressed by the public attitude towards the Omsk government. When I saw France's former ambassador to Tokyo and questioned him about the attitude of Allies toward the government, Mr. Renault said, quote, "I am glad to know that the people at the head of this government are men of good faith, honest, serious, and able. The Allies have not yet recognized them, but I think they are favorably disposed. From all I have seen, the population is quite in accord with the government because it proposes to establish order, while the Bolsheviks only want disaster. I came here representing France for the purpose of interviewing the government officials. While I cannot say now what attitude France will take, I believe the Allies and the French plan will be first to see what this government means, second, to encourage it if necessary, and third, if the Allies see this government is giving good administration, then to extend recognition to it as the government of all Russia. Since the formation of the Russian government, the Siberian government has ceased to exist. I know the government officials personally and always found them ready and willing to work with Allies." End quote. I asked the High Commissioner about Prince Lvov's mission. He answered, quote, "Lvov is the unofficial representative of the new government. In all of his remarks, the prince has always spoken highly of this government, saying the directors and ministers were honest, patriotic, and energetic. When I asked how long the Bolsheviks were expected to hold out, Mr. Renault smiled, saying, "We hope that with Allied help from the Black Sea, Archangel, and through the Czechs here, the Bolshevik strength will break. England, France, and Italy are all sending troops to aid the Czechs. When the Czechs know we are coming to their assistance, that help is coming from all sides, and that the Germans are withdrawing from Russia, it will encourage them. This is the whole situation here. The only question is the morale of the Allies against the morale of the Bolsheviks. Captain Gaston Bourgeois and Captain Pushkov accompany Mr. Renault." And that's the end of the article. And I just like to remind people of what the minister from the Netherlands said. "I'm of the opinion that no support whatever should be given to any other socialist party in Russia, least of all to social revolutionaries whose policy it is at the moment to overthrow the Bolsheviks, but whose aims in reality are the same, vis-a-vis to establish proletariat rule through the world. Social revolutionaries will never fight any foreign power, and any profession which they may now make in this sense are merely a tactical move in their struggle with the Bolsheviks."
Now, Omsk is it's actually far north of India, and it's very close to Tibet. You know, it's pretty far to the east, and probably comfortably far away from Moscow and Petrograd. And
1,700 miles from Moscow.
Yeah.
And it's in the Ural Mountains.
So I'm sure that gave him a little courage, but it didn't last. I think we should call it here and pick up here next week.
All right, excellent. All right, then, thank you.
Thank you. Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.